This is tape 2, side 1, Century of Light, continuing from page 32.
Reflection on the magnitude of the suffering experienced by humankind in the war's 4 years, and the resulting setback to the long, painful process of the civilizing of human nature, lends tragic force to words the Master had addressed only 2 or 3 years earlier to audiences in such European cities as London, Paris, Vienna, Budapest, in Stuttgart, as well as in North America. Speaking one evening in the home of Mr. and Mrs. Sutherland Maxwell in Montreal, he had said, quote, "Today the world of humanity is walking in darkness because it is out of touch with the world of God. That is why we do not see the signs of God in the hearts of men. The power of the Holy Spirit has no influence. When a divine spiritual illumination becomes manifest in the world of humanity, when divine instruction and guidance appear, then enlightenment follows. A new spirit is realized within, a new power descends, and a new life is given. It is like the birth from the animal kingdom into the kingdom of man. I will pray, and you must pray likewise, that such heavenly bounty may be realized, that strife and enmity may be banished, warfare and bloodshed taken away, that hearts may attain ideal communication, and that all people may drink from the same fountain." Page 33. Footnote, Abdu'l-Bahá, The Promulgation of Universal Peace, page 305. The vindictive peace treaty imposed by the Allied powers on their defeated enemies succeeded only, as both Abdu'l-Bahá and Shoghi Effendi have pointed out, in planting the seeds of another, far more terrible conflict. The ruinous reparations demanded of the vanquished, and the injustice that required them to accept the full guilt for a war for which all parties had been, to one degree or another, responsible, were among the factors that would prepare demoralized peoples in Europe to embrace totalitarian promises of relief which they might not otherwise have contemplated. Ironically, no matter how harsh were the reparations required of the defeated, the supposed victors awoke to the appalled realization that their triumph, and the demand for unconditional surrender that had driven it, had come at an equally crippling price. Staggering war debts ended forever the economic dominance which these European nations had acquired through 3 centuries of imperialistic exploitation of the rest of the planet. The deaths of millions of young men who would have been urgently needed to meet the challenges of the coming decades was a loss that could never be recovered. Indeed, Europe itself, which only 4 brief years earlier had represented the apparent summit of civilization and world influence, lost at one stroke this preeminence and began the inexorable slide during the following decades toward the status of an auxiliary to a rising new center of power in North America. Initially, it seemed that the vision of the future conceived by Woodrow Wilson would now be realized. In part, this proved to be the case as subject peoples throughout Europe gained the freedom to work out their own destinies through the emergence from the ruin of the former empires of a series of new nation-states. Further, the President's 14 points briefly endowed his public statements with so great a moral authority in the minds of millions of Europeans that not even the most recalcitrant of his fellow leaders among the Allied powers could entirely disregard his wishes. Page 34. Despite months of wrangling over colonies, borders, and clauses in the text of the peace treaty, the Versailles settlement eventually incorporated an attenuated form of the proposed League of Nations, an institution which it was hoped could adjust future disputes between nations and harmonize international affairs. Shoghi Effendi's commentary on the significance of this historic initiative commands reflection on the part of every Baha'i who seeks to understand the events of this turbulent century. Describing 2 closely interrelated developments that are associated with the dawn of world peace, he lays emphasis on the fact that they are, quote, "destined to culminate in the fullness of time in a single glorious consummation," end quote. Shoghi Effendi, Citadel of Faith, page 32. The first, the Guardian describes, as associated with the mission of the Baha'i community in North America continent. The second, with the destiny of the United States as a nation. Speaking of this latter phenomenon, which dated back to the outbreak of the First World War, Shoghi Effendi writes, quote, It received its initial impetus through the formulation of President Wilson's 14 points, closely associating for the first time that republic with the fortunes of the old world. It suffered its first setback through the disassociation of that republic from the newly born League of Nations, which that president had labored to create. It must, however long and torturous the way, lead through a series of victories and reverses to the political unification of the Eastern and Western hemispheres, to the emergence of a world government, and the establishment of the lesser peace, as foretold by Baha'u'llah and foreshadowed by the prophet Isaiah. It must in the end culminate in the unfurling of the banner of the Most Great Peace in the golden age of the dispensation of Baha'u'llah. End quote. Siddle Faith, page 32-33. How tragic, therefore, was the fate of the conception that had inspired the efforts of the American president. As soon became apparent, the League had been stillborn. Although it included such features as a legislature, a judiciary, an executive, and a supporting bureaucracy, it had been denied the authority vital to the work it was ostensibly intended to perform. Locked into the 19th century's conception of untrammeled national sovereignty, it could take decisions only with the unanimous assent of the member states, a requirement largely ruling out effective action. Page 35. Footnote. As finally adopted, Article 10 of the Covenant of the League did not require collective military intervention in cases of aggression, but merely stated that, quote, the Council shall advise upon the means by which this obligation shall be fulfilled. End footnote. The hollowness of the system was exposed, as well, by its failure to include some of the world's most powerful states. Germany had been rejected as a defeated nation held responsible for the war. Russia was initially denied entrance because of its Bolshevik regime, and the United States itself refused, as a result of narrow political partisanship in Congress, either to join the League or to ratify the treaty. Ironically, even the half-hearted efforts made to protect ethnic minorities living in the newly created nation-states proved eventually to be little more than weapons to be used in Europe's continuing fratricidal conflicts. In sum, at precisely the moment in human history when an unprecedented outbreak of violence had undermined the inherited bulwarks of civilized behavior, the political leadership of the Western world had emasculated the one alternative system of international order to which experience of this catastrophe had given birth, and which alone could have alleviated the far greater suffering that lay ahead. In the prophetic words of Abdu'l-Bahá, quote, peace, peace, the lips of potentates and peoples unceasingly proclaim, whereas the fire of unquenched hatreds still smolder in their hearts. Quote, the ills from which the world now suffers, he added in 1920, will multiply, the gloom which envelops it will deepen, the vanquished powers will continue to agitate, they will resort to every measure that may rekindle the flame of war. End quote. Shoghi Effendi, The World Order, Baha'u'llah, page 29-30. As war's inferno was engulfing the world, Abdu'l-Bahá turned his attention to the one great task remaining in his ministry, that of ensuring the proclamation to the remotest corners of the earth of the message which had been neglected or opposed in Islamic and Western society alike. The instrument he devised for this purpose was the Divine Plan, laid out in 14 great tablets, four of them addressed to the Baha'i community of North America, and 10 subsidiary ones addressed to five specific segments of that community. Together with Baha'u'llah's Tablet of Carmel and the Master's Will and Testament, page 436, the tablets of the Divine Plan were described by Shoghi Effendi as three of the charters of the cause. Revealed during the darkest days of the war, in 1916 and 1917, the Divine Plan summoned the small body of American and Canadian believers to assume the role of leadership in establishing the cause of God throughout the planet. The implications of the trust were awe-inspiring. In the words of the Master, quote, the hope which Abdu'l-Bahá cherishes for you is that the same success which has attended your efforts in America may crown your endeavors in other parts of the world, that through you the fame of the cause of God may be diffused throughout the East and the West, and the advent of the kingdom of the Lord of hosts be proclaimed in all the five continents of the globe. The moment this divine message is carried forward by the American believers from the shores of America and is propagated through the continents of Europe, of Asia, of Africa, and of Australia, and as far as the islands of the Pacific, this community will find itself securely established upon the throne of an everlasting dominion. Then will all the peoples of the world witness that this community is spiritually illumined and divinely guided. Then will the whole earth resound with the praises of its majesty and greatness. End quote. Shaghi Effendi, Citadel of Faith, pages 28-29. Shaghi Effendi reminds us that this historic mission, described by him as, quote, the birthright of the North American Baha'i community, end quote, and that's from also Citadel of Faith, page 7, is rooted in the words of the twin manifestations of God to humanity's age of maturity. It appeared first in the words of the Bab, who called on the peoples of the West to issue forth from your cities, to aid God ere the day when the Lord of mercy shall come down unto you in the shadow of the clouds, and to become, as true brethren in the one and indivisible religion of God, free from distinction, so that ye find yourselves reflected in them, and they in you. That's selections from the writings of the Bab, page 56. In his summons to the rulers of America and the presidents of the republics therein, Baha'u'llah himself delivered a mandate that has no parallel in any of his other addresses to world leaders. Page 37. Quote, bind ye the broken with the hands of justice, and crush the oppressor who flourisheth with the rod of the commandments of your Lord, the Ordainer, the All-Wise. It's Baha'u'llah, the Kitab-i Aqdas, paragraph 88. It was Baha'u'llah, too, who enunciated one of the most profound truths about the process by which the civilization has evolved. Quote, in the East the light of his revelation hath broken, in the West hath appeared the signs of his dominion. Ponder this in your hearts, O people. End quote. Tablets of Baha'u'llah revealed after the Kitab-i Aqdas, page 13. Although the divine plan would, as the Guardian was later to say, be held in abeyance until the system necessary to its execution had been brought into being, Abdu'l-Bahá had selected, empowered, and mandated a company of believers who would take the lead in launching the enterprise. His own life was now swiftly moving to its end, but the 3 years left to him after the conclusion of the World War seemed, in retrospect, to provide a foretaste of the victories that the cause itself would know as the century unfolded. The changed conditions in the Holy Land freed the master to pursue his work unhampered and created the conditions in which the brilliance of his mind and spirit could exercise their influence on government officials, visiting dignitaries of every kind, and the various communities making up the population of the Holy Land. The mandate power itself sought to express its appreciation of the unifying effect of his example and the philanthropic work he did by conferring upon him a knighthood. Footnote, the citation made reference to the value of the master's advice to the British military authorities who were attempting to restore civil life following the overthrow of the Turkish regime in the area, adding that all his influence has been for good. See Mujam Momed, The Babi and Baha'i Religions, 1844-1944, Some Contemporary Western Accounts, page 344. End of footnote. More importantly, a renewed flow of pilgrims and of tablets to Baha'i communities of both East and West stimulated an expansion to the teaching work and a deepening of the friend's understanding of the implications of the faith's message. Nothing perhaps illustrated so dramatically the spiritual triumph the Master had won at the world center of the faith than the events in Haifa that occurred immediately after his ascension in the early hours of 28 November 1921. The following day, a vast concourse of thousands of people, representing the variegated races and sects of the region, followed the funeral cortege up the slopes of Mount Carmel in a state of unaffected grief such as the city had never before witnessed. It was led by representatives of the British government, members of the diplomatic community, and the heads of all the religious bodies in the area, several of whom participated in the service at the Shrine of the Bab. So unrestrained and unified, an outburst of mourning reflected a sudden awareness of the loss of a figure whose example has served as a focal center of unity in an angry and divided land. 38. In itself, it served for all with eyes to see as a compelling vindication of the truth of the oneness of humankind, which the Master had tirelessly proclaimed. Page 39, Chapter 4. With the passing of Abdu'l-Bahá, the apostolic age of the cause reached its end. The divine intervention that had begun 77 years earlier on the night when the Bab declared his mission to Mulu Hussein and Abdu'l-Bahá himself was born, had completed its work. It had been, in the words of Shoghi Effendi, quote, a period whose splendors no victories in this or any future age, however brilliant, can rival, end quote. Baha'i World, Volume 15, page 132. Ahead lay the thousands or thousands of years in which the potentialities that this creative force has planted in human consciousness will gradually unfold. Contemplation of so great a juncture in the history of civilization brings into sharp focus the figure whose nature and role have been unique in this 6,000-year process. Baha'u'llah has called Abdu'l-Bahá the mystery of God. Shoghi Effendi has described him as the center and pivot of Baha'u'llah's covenant, the perfect exemplar of the teachings of the revelation of God for the age of human maturity, and the mainspring of the oneness of humanity. No phenomenon in any way comparable to his appearance had accompanied any of the divine revelations that had given birth to the other great religious systems in recorded history. All of these had been essentially stages preparing humanity for its coming of age. Abdu'l-Bahá was Baha'u'llah's supreme creation, the one that made everything else possible. Page 40. An understanding of this truth moved a perceptive American Baha'i to write, quote, now a message from God must be delivered, and there was no mankind to hear this message. Therefore, God gave the world Abdu'l-Bahá. Abdu'l-Bahá received the message of Baha'u'llah on behalf of the human race. He heard the voice of God. He was inspired by the Spirit. He attained complete consciousness and awareness of the meaning of this message, and he pledged the human race to respond to the voice of God. To me, that is the covenant, that there was on this earth someone who could be a representative of an as yet uncreated race. There were only tribes, families, creeds, classes, etc., but there was no man except Abdu'l-Bahá. And Abdu'l-Bahá, as man, took to himself the message of Baha'u'llah and promised God that he would bring the people into the oneness of mankind and create a humanity that could be the vehicle for the laws of God. End quote. Horace Holly, Religion for Mankind, pages 243-244. Beginning his mission as a prisoner of a brutal, ignorant regime and relentlessly assailed by faithless brothers who ultimately sought his death, the Master single-handedly created of the Persian Baha'i community a brilliant demonstration of the social development the cause could produce, inspired the expansion of the faith across the Orient, raised up communities of devoted believers throughout the West, designed a plan for the worldwide expansion of the cause, won the respect and admiration of leaders of thought wherever his influence reached, and provided Baha'u'llah's followers throughout the world with a vast body of authoritative guidance as to the intent of the faith's laws and teachings. On the slopes of Mount Carmel, he erected with enormous pain and difficulty the shrine housing the mortal remains of the martyred Bab, the focal point of the processes by which the life of our planet will gradually be organized. Through it all, in every least occasion of a life filled with cares and demands of every sort, a life exposed at all times to examination by enemy and friend alike, he ensured that posterity will possess that treasure of which poets, philosophers, and mystics have dreamed all down through the ages, a demonstration of unshadowed human perfection. Page 41. And finally, it was Abdu'l-Bahá who made certain that the divine order conceived by Baha'u'llah for the unification of the human race and the institution of justice in humanity's collective life would be provided with the means required to realize its founder's purpose. For unity to exist among human beings at even the simplest level, two fundamental conditions must pertain. Those involved first must of all be in some agreement about the nature of reality as it affects their relationship with one another and with the phenomenal world. They must, secondly, give assent to some recognized and authoritative means by which decisions will be taken that affect their association with one another and that determine their collective goals. Unity is not, that is, merely a condition resulting from a sense of mutual goodwill and common purpose, however profound and sincerely held such sentiments may be, any more than an organism is a product of some fortuitous and amorphous association of various elements. Unity is a phenomenon of creative power whose existence becomes apparent through the effects that collective action produces and whose absence is betrayed by the impotence of such efforts. However handicapped it often has been by ignorance and perversity, this force has been the primary influence driving the advancement of civilization, generating legal codes, social and political institutions, artistic works, technological achievements without end, moral breakthroughs, material prosperity, and long periods of public peace whose afterglow lived in the memories of subsequent generations as imagined golden ages. Through the revelation of God to humanity's coming of age, the full potentialities of this creative force have at last been released, and the means necessary to the realization of the divine purpose have been instituted. In his will and testament, which Shoghi Effendi has described as the charter of the administrative order, Abdu'l-Bahá set out in detail the nature and role of the twin institutions that are his appointed successors and whose complementary functions ensure the unity of the Baha'i cause and the achievement of its mission throughout the dispensation, the guardianship, and the universal house of justice. He laid particularly strong emphasis on the authority thus conveyed. Page 42. Quote, whatsoever they decide is of God. Whoso obeyeth him not, neither obeyeth them, hath not obeyed God. Whoso rebelleth against him, and against them that have hath rebelled against God. Whoso opposeth him, hath opposed God. Who contendeth with them, hath contended with God. End quote. From the Will and Testament of Abdu'l-Bahá, page 11. Shoghi Effendi has explained the significance of this extraordinary text. Quote, the administrative order which this historic document has established, it should be noticed, is, by virtue of its origin and character, unique in the annals of the world's religious systems. No prophet before Baha'u'llah, it can be confidently asserted, has established authoritatively and in writing anything comparable to the administrative order which the authorized interpreter of Baha'u'llah's teachings has instituted, an order which must and will, in a manner unparalleled in any previous religion, safeguard from schism the faith from which it has sprung. End quote. Shoghi Effendi passes by, page 326. Before the reading and promulgation of the Will and Testament, the great majority of the members of the faith had assumed that the next stage in the evolution of the cause would be the election of the Universal House of Justice, the institution founded by Baha'u'llah himself in the Kitab-i Aqdas as the governing body of the Baha'i world. An important fact for present-day Baha'is to understand is that prior to this point, the concept of guardianship was unknown to the Baha'i community. There was widespread rejoicing at the news of the unique distinction that the Master had conferred on Shoghi Effendi and the continuing link with the founders of the faith that his role represented. Until then, however, there had been no appreciation of Baha'u'llah's intent that such an institution should emerge, or of the interpretive function it would have to perform, a function whose vital importance has since become readily apparent, and which hindsight makes clear were implicit in certain of his writings. What was entirely beyond the imagination of anyone then living, whether faithful or ill-disposed, was the transformation in the life of the cause that the will of the Master set in motion. Quote, were ye to know what will come to pass after me, Abdu'l-Bahá had declared, surely would ye pray that my end be hastened. End quote. Shoghi Effendi Baha'i Administration, page 15. Page 43, chapter 5. An appreciation of the place of the guardianship in Baha'i history must begin with an objective consideration of the circumstances in which Shoghi Effendi's mission had to be carried out. Particularly important is the fact that the first half of his ministry unfolded between wars, a period marked by deepening uncertainty and anxiety about all aspects of human affairs. On the one hand, significant advances have been made in overcoming barriers between nations and classes. On the other, political impotence and a resulting economic paralysis greatly handicapped efforts to take advantages of these openings. There was everywhere a sense that some fundamental redefinition of the nature of society and the role its institutions should play was urgently needed. A redefinition, indeed, of the purpose of human life itself. In important respects, humanity found itself at the end of the First World War able to explore possibilities never before imagined. Throughout Europe and the Near East, the absolutist systems that have been among the most powerful barriers to unity have been swept away. To a great extent, too, fossilized religious dogmas that had lent moral endorsement to the forces of conflict and alienation were everywhere in question. Former subject peoples were free to consider plans for their collective futures, page 44, and to assume responsibility for their relationships with one another through the instrumentality of the new nation-states created by the Versailles Settlement. The same ingenuity that had gone into producing weapons of destruction was being turned to the challenging but rewarding tasks of economic expansion. Out of the darkest days of the war had come poignant stories, such as the impulse that had briefly moved British and German soldiers to leave the slaughterhouse of the trenches to commemorate together the birth of Christ, providing a flickering glimpse of the oneness of the human race, which the Master had tirelessly proclaimed in his journeys across that same continent. Footnote: although the Christmas truce involved principally British and German soldiers, French and Belgian troops also participated. BBC News Online Network summary of Brown, Malcolm, and Shirley Seaton, Christmas Truce. End of footnote. Most important of all, an extraordinary effort of imagination had brought the unification of humanity one immense step forward. The world's leaders, however reluctantly, had created an international consultative system which, though crippled by vested interests, gave the ideal of international order its first suggestion of shape and structure. The post-war awakening expressed itself worldwide. Under the leadership of Sun Yat-sen, the Chinese people had already thrown off the decadent imperial regime that had compromised the country's well-being, and were seeking to lay foundations of a rebirth of that country's greatness. Throughout Latin America, despite terrible and repeated setbacks, popular movements were likewise struggling to gain control over their country's destinies and the use of their continent's immense natural resources. In India, one of the century's most remarkable figures, Mohandas Gandhi, embarked on an enterprise that would not only revolutionize the fortunes of his country, but also demonstrate conclusively to the world what spiritual force can achieve. Africa was still waiting its moment of destiny, as were the inhabitants of other colonial lands, but for anyone with eyes to see, a process of change had been set in motion that could ultimately not be suppressed, because it represented the universal yearnings of humankind. These advances, however encouraging, could not conceal the historic tragedy that had occurred. During the second half of the 19th century, the proclamation of the Day of God addressed by Baha'u'llah to the rulers of his day, in whose hands lay the destiny of humankind, had been either rejected or ignored by its recipients in both East and West. Page 45. Reflection on so great a breach of faith throws it into sobering perspective the subsequent response that had set met the mission of Abdu'l-Bahá to the West. However much one may rejoice in the praise poured on the Master from every quarter, the immediate results of his efforts represented yet another immense moral failure on the part of a considerable portion of humankind and of its leadership. The message that had been suppressed in the East was essentially ignored by a Western world which had proceeded down the path of ruin long prepared for it by overweening self-satisfaction, leading finally to the betrayal of the ideal embodied in the League of Nations. In consequence, the 2 decades immediately after Shoghi Effendi assumed his responsibility for the vindication of the cause of God were a period of deepening gloom throughout the Western world, which seemed to reflect a massive setback in the process of integration and enlightenment so confidently proclaimed by the Master. It was as if political, social, and economic life had fallen into a kind of limbo. Grave doubts developed about the capacity of the liberal democratic tradition to cope with the problems of the times. Indeed, in a number of European countries, governments inspired by such principles were replaced by authoritarian regimes. Soon, the economic crash of 1929 led to a worldwide reduction in material well-being, with all the further moral and psychological insecurities that resulted. An appreciation of these circumstances helps us to understand the magnitude of the challenge facing Shoghi Effendi at the outset of his ministry. So far as the objective condition of humankind, as he encountered it, was concerned, there was nothing that would have inspired confidence that the vision of a new world bequeathed him by the founders of the Baha'i cause could be significantly advanced during whatever span of years might be allowed him. Nor did the instrument available to him appear to possess the strength, the resilience, or the sophistication his task required. In 1923, when Shoghi Effendi was eventually able to assume full direction of the cause, the core of the Baha'u'llah's followers consisted of a body of believers in Iran, of whose number not even a reliable estimate could have been produced. Denied most of the means necessary to their promotion of the cause, page 46, and severely limited in the material resources at their disposal, the Iranian community was hedged about by constant harassment. In North America, charged with the daunting responsibilities of the divine plan, small communities of believers found themselves struggling with the simple challenges of making a livelihood for themselves and their families as the economic crisis steadily deepened. In Europe, Australasia, and the Far East, even smaller Baha'i groups kept the flame of the faith alive, as did isolated groups, families, and individuals scattered throughout the rest of the world. Literature, even in English, was inadequate, and the task of translating the writings into other major languages and of finding the funds to publish them represented an almost impossible burden. Though the vision communicated by the Master burned as brightly as ever, the means at their disposal must have appeared to Baha'is as pitifully inadequate in the face of the conditions prevailing everywhere. The hulking black foundation of the future Mother Temple of the West, rising over the lakefront north of Chicago, seemed to mock the brilliant conception that had bedazzled the architectural world only a few years before. In Baghdad, the Most Holy House, designated by Baha'u'llah as the focal center of Baha'i pilgrimage, had been seized by opponents of the faith. In the Holy Land itself, the mansion of Baha'u'llah was falling into ruin as a result of neglect by the covenant breakers who occupied it, and the shrine housing the precious remains of both the Bab and Abdul Baha had progressed no further than the simple stone structure raised by the Master. A series of exploratory consultations with leading Baha'is made it clear to the Guardian that even a formal discussion with qualified believers about the creation of an international secretariat would be not only useless, but probably counterproductive. It was alone, therefore, that Shoghi Effendi set out on the task of propelling forward the vast enterprise entrusted to his hands. How completely alone he was is almost impossible for the present generation of Baha'is to grasp. To the extent one does grasp it, the realization is acutely painful. Initially, the Guardian assumed that the members of the Master's extended family, whose distinguished lineage brought them immense respect from Baha'is everywhere, would welcome the opportunity to assist him in realizing the purpose that the Master's will had set out in language so imperative and moving. Page 47. Accordingly, he invited his brothers, his cousins, and one of his sisters, whose education made them qualified for the purpose, to provide the administrative support that the demanding work of the guardianship required. Tragically, as time passed, one after another of these persons proved dissatisfied with the supporting role thus assigned and careless in the discharge of its functions. Far more seriously, Shoghi Effendi found himself facing a situation in which the authority conferred on him, although expressed in uncompromising terms in the will and testament, was seen by those related to him as relatively nominal in character. These individuals preferred to regard the leadership of the faith as essentially a family affair, in which great weight should be placed on the views of senior figures among them, who were supposedly qualified to assume such a prerogative. Beginning with demonstrations of sullen resistance, the situation steadily deteriorated to a point where the children and grandchildren of Abdu'l-Bahá felt free to disagree with his appointed successor and to disobey his instructions. Rahia Khanum, who saw this process of deterioration in its later stages, and herself suffered greatly in witnessing its effects on both the work of the cause and the guardian personally, has written, quote, "One must understand the old story of Cain and Abel, a story of family jealousies which, like a somber thread in the fabric of history, runs through all its epochs and can be traced in all its events. The weakness of the human heart, which so often attaches itself to an unworthy object, the weakness of the human mind, prone to conceit and self-assurance and personal opinions, envelop people in a welter of emotions that blind their judgment and lead them far astray. Even though this phenomenon of covenant breaking seems to be an inherent aspect of religion, this does not mean it produces no damaging effect on the cause. Above all, it does not mean that a devastating effect is not produced on the center of the covenant himself. Shoghi Effendi's whole life was darkened by the vicious personal attacks made upon him." Ruhi Rabbani, The Priceless Pearl, pages 121 and 123. The somber background casts in all the more brilliant light the achievements of the greatest holy leaf, sister of Abdu'l-Bahá, and last survivor of the faith's heroic age. Page 48. Bahia Khanum played a vital role in guarding the interests of the cause after the master's death and became Shoghi Effendi's sole effective support. Her fidelity evoked from his pen perhaps the most deeply moving passages he was ever to write. The apostrophe he addressed to her after her passing in 1932 was set in a letter to the Baha'is throughout the West, which itself read in part, quote, "Only future generations and pens abler than mine can and will pay a worthy tribute to the towering grandeur of her spiritual life, to the unique part she played throughout the tumultuous stages of Baha'i history, to the expressions of unqualified praise that have streamed from the pen of both Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá, the center of his covenant, though unrecorded and in the main unsuspected by the mass of her passionate admirers in East and West, the share she has had in influencing the course of some of the chief events in the annals of the faith, the sufferings she bore, the sacrifices she made, the rare gifts of unfailing sympathy she so strikingly displayed, these and many others stand so inextricably interwoven with the fabric of the cause itself, that no future historian of the faith of Baha'u'llah can afford to ignore or minimize. Which of the blessings am I to recount, which in her unfailing solicitude she showered upon me in the most critical and agitated hours of my life? To me, standing in so dire a need of the vitalizing grace of God, she was the symbol, living symbol of many an attribute I had learned to admire in Abdu'l-Bahá." End of quote. Shoghi Effendi Baha'i Administration, pages 187-188 and page 194. For long years, the guardian felt that the protection of the cause required him to maintain silence about the deteriorating situation in the Holy Family. Only as opposition finally burst into acts of open defiance, eventually involving the family in shameful collaboration and even marriages with members of the very band of covenant breakers against whose treachery the will and testament of the master had warned in vehement language, as well as with a local family deeply hostile to the cause, did Shoghi Effendi eventually feel compelled to expose to the Baha'i world the nature of the delinquencies with which he was having to deal. Footnote, in case after case, the open dismissed behavior of Shoghi Effendi's brothers, sisters, and cousins left him finally with no alternative but to advise the Baha'i world that these individuals had violated the covenant. End of footnote. Page 49. This sad history is of importance to an understanding of the cause in the 20th century, not only because of what the Guardian called the havoc it wreaked in the Holy Family, but because of the light it casts on the challenges the Baha'i community will increasingly face in the years ahead. Challenges predicted in explicit language by both the Master and the Guardian. Apart from the insincerity that marked all too many of them, the relatives of Shoghi Effendi demonstrated little or no awareness of the spiritual nature of the role conferred on him in the Will and Testament. That the revelation of God to the age of humanity's maturity should have brought with it, as a central feature of its mission, an authority essential for the restructuring of social order represented a spiritual challenge they seemed unable, or perhaps never sought, to understand. Their abandonment of the Guardian is a lesson that will remain with posterity down through the centuries of the Baha'i dispensation. The fate of this most privileged but unworthy company of human beings underlies for all who read their story both the significance that the covenant of Baha'u'llah holds for the unification of humankind and the uncompromising demands it makes on those who seek its shelter. In considering the events of the ministry of Shoghi Effendi, Baha'is need to make the effort of imagination to see through his eyes the nature of the mission laid on him. Our guide is the body of writings he has left. Abdu'l-Bahá had proclaimed in countless tablets and talks the pivotal principle of Baha'u'llah's message. Quote, in this wondrous revelation, this glorious century, the foundation of the faith of God and the distinguishing feature of his law is the consciousness of the oneness of mankind. Footnote, Shoghi Effendi, The World Order of Baha'u'llah, page 36. Abdu'l-Bahá had been equally emphatic in asserting, as already noted, that the revolutionary changes taking place in every field of human endeavor now made the unification of humanity a realistic objective. It was this vision that, for the 36 years of his guardianship, provided the organizing force of Shoghi Effendi's work. Its implications were the theme of some of the most important messages he wrote. Page 50. Addressing in 1931 the Friends of the West, he opened for them a brilliant vista. Quote, the principle of the oneness of mankind, the pivot round which all the teachings of Baha'u'llah revolve, is no mere outburst of ignorant emotionalism or an expression of vague and pious hope. Its appeal is not to be merely identified with a reawakening of the spirit of brotherhood and goodwill among men, nor does it aim solely at the fostering of harmonious cooperation among individual peoples and nations. Its implications are deeper, its claims greater than any which the prophets of old were allowed to advance. Its message is applicable not only to the individual, but concerns itself primarily with the nature of those essential relationships that must bind all the states and nations as members of one human family. It implies an organic change in the structure of present-day society, a change such as the world has not experienced. It calls for no less than the reconstruction and the demilitarization of the whole civilized world, a world organically unified in all the essential aspects of its life, its political machinery, its spiritual aspiration, its trade and finance, its script and language, and yet infinite in the diversity of the national characteristics of its federated units. End quote. World Order Baha'u'llah, pages 42-43. A concept that showed itself strongly in the Guardian's writings was the organic metaphor in which Baha'u'llah, and subsequently Abdu'l-Bahá, had captured the millennia-long process that has carried humanity to this culminating point in its collective history. That image was the analogy that can be drawn between, on the one hand, the stages by which human society has been gradually organized and integrated, and on the other, the process by which each human being slowly develops out of the limitations of infantile existence into the powers of maturity. It appears prominently in several of Shoghi Effendi's writings on the transformation taking place in our time. Quote, "The long ages of infancy and childhood through which the human race had to pass have receded into the background, humanity now experiencing the commotions invariably associated with the most turbulent stage of its evolution," page 51, "the stage of adolescence, when the impetuosity of youth and its vehemence reach their climax, and must gradually be superseded by the calmness, the wisdom, and the maturity that characterize the stage of manhood." End quote. World Order Baha'u'llah, page 202.
This is the end of side one. Please stop the tape, turn it over, and continue on side two.